Chapter 16. Close Quarters. McColl buckled the Sirdar's helmet back on. He glanced at the other three, made the Tanith hand sign for mute, and walked off along the brig. The interrogation he had observed on his way in was finished, and the cell door locked. He wondered if the Urdeshi colonel inside was still alive. He hoped to the throne he was not. The two Paxan watchmen were still on duty in the security post. One opened the inner cage to let him through. The other stood leaning on the back grip of the sentry gun. The Paxan with the key remarked that the Sirdar had been a long time. McColl replied that the best work often took a long time.
"Arneth, then, why?"
the Paxan asked. "So you got what you wanted?" "Then harnek te," McColl replied. Everything it was possible to get. With an open palm slap, he rammed the pain goad into the keyholder's solar plexus. The man's entire system shut down. His mouth opened to voice the unthinkable agony that was screaming through his nervous system, but his vocal cords and lungs no longer worked. He buckled to the deck. The other watchman turned from the sentry gun in surprise as his comrade collapsed. McColl was already on him. The skerrit went in between his ribs. 2 kills, 3 seconds, no sound. McColl used the watchman's key to reopen the inner cage and dragged both bodies through. He stood in plain sight at the end of the brig corridor and made the hand sign for clear. Milo and Mazo hurried down to him. Holofernes followed, limping.
"Uniforms," McColl said.
Milo and the colonel stripped the Paxons of their kit and pulled it on. The fit was poor, but it would have to do. McColl went back into the security post and searched the area. Both Paxons had been armed with old fleet pattern las carbines, which were hooked onto a wall rack. Decent weapons, short pattern, for use in shipboard environments. The Paxons had kept them clean and in good order. The more disciplined Astra Militarum-style regimen, observed by both Sekite Pax and the Blood Pact, had some benefits. Milo and Mazo would have spare clips in the overrigs of the uniforms they were acquiring, as well as ritual daggers. As they entered the cage in uniform, McColl tossed a carbine to each man.
"Carry them down over the crook of the arm," he said.
"Paxons don't shoulder weapons." Milo nodded. Holofernes appeared.
"No disguising me," he said.
McColl knew there wouldn't be. Most of what would follow was going to be improvisation, though McColl had talked them through a few basic plays. Holofernes took the big Urdeshi sentry gun off its tripod. It looked like a regular auto gun in his paws. He picked up the ammo box and made sure the belt between box and weapon was slack enough not to jam with any sudden movement. McColl opened the outer cage.
"Someone will soon spot that the brig watch is unmanned," said Mazo.
He was having difficulty getting his spectacles to sit comfortably inside the stolen helmet and its ghastly mouthguard.
"The plan isn't perfect," McColl replied. "Sooner or later, someone is going to spot that not everything on board is the way it should be."
They moved through the ship, rising to deck 7 and then 6. McColl led the way, and every time he heard movement or spotted personnel approaching, he signed to the men behind him, and Holofernes pulled himself into cover, a bulkhead, a through-deck well, or an inspection bay. As soon as the contact passed, McColl moved them on. At a junction on deck 6, they had to wait for almost 15 minutes while work crews and servitor gangs moved machine parts through on trucks. Once it was clear, they hurried on, through a compartment air gate, and followed a shadowed walkway that ran along the side of a large processing bay. In the harshly lit space below them, they saw gun crew servitors loading huge munition shells into the bare metal clamps of conveyor trains. Tall figures in dappled golden gowns supervised the labor, shouting instructions through handheld voxhorns. As each half-ton shell loaded, the automated track rattled forwards and lowered them into deck shafts, where they descended on hydraulic rotators into the autoloader magazines on the battery deck. McColl and the others watched for a moment from the shadow of the rail. The enemy warship still had fight in it. Mazo looked at McColl with one eyebrow raised. McColl shook his head. Due to their sheer size and power, shift ship munitions were remarkably stable and inert until selected for use. They could waste hours trying to force a shell to detonate, and even then there was no guarantee of a cascade in the magazines. And they didn't have hours. On deck 5, they waited as an excubitor strode past with 2 lect psykers hobbling in his wake. then almost ran into a Damagawa and a squad of six Paxans. McCall didn't even have time to signal, but he knew Holofernes must have slipped out of sight behind him, because the Damagawa started to question McCall and his two Paxans about the location of an Itagawa called Karain.
"I haven't seen him, Damagawa," McCall replied. "Perhaps he is on the bridge with he whose voice commands the stars."
The Damagawa looked at him, annoyed.
"The Holy Magister's not on the bridge, you shit-stain," he snapped. "When was the Holy Magister last on the bridge?"
"Apologies, Damagawa, of course not," said McCall quickly. "I misspoke. I meant—"
"No, I've tried there too," the Damagawa replied. "The oratory is closed to all at the moment. Karain must be ashore, then."
He cursed.
"What is your name, Sirdar?"
he asked.
"Eloth, my Magir."
"If you see Magir Karain, Sirdar Eloth, tell him the shipmaster needs those manifest orders by dawn. Dawn, you understand?"
"Yes, my Magir."
The Damagawa snapped his fingers, and his pack followed him away down the hall.
"What was that?" whispered Mazo. "Our objective's no longer the bridge," McCall replied.
"So where?" asked Milo.
"The oratory."
"And where's that?" asked Mazo.
"I have no fething idea," replied McCall.
They reached Deck 3 and almost immediately entered a large section that was undergoing heavy repairs. Work crews of industrial servitors were fitting new armor linings along a section of hull panel that ran for about 60 meters. Welding arrays sparked furiously. Slave gangs were wheeling out tubs laden with fused scrap metal and lumps of slag that had been stripped out from the failed lining. McCall got his little squad in temporary cover and then walked on through the repair zone alone. He spotted an open compartment where two provision officers in filthy golden robes were arguing about puncture sealant. The compartment was being used as a supervision post for their work. It was stacked with tools and rebreather sets. There was a small work table covered in junk and requisition dockets. He strolled up to the provision officers, and as he did so, realized they weren't Paxans of the Sekite host. They were Veduak, companions of a different tribal order that served as the equivalent of navy personnel for the Arcanate fleet. They were tall men, larger than McCall had realized when he first approached, their big-boned mass and heavy muscle speaking of many family generations serving in high-gravity shift operations. He had encountered the Veduak's brutal tech cannibal shock troops before, but not the ruling class. Their heads were shaved except for long, square beards, and they had dented blast visors lowered to their chests. Their faces were fetishistically covered in piercings, so many in the ears that the flesh was stretched. Their scalps were covered in complex tattoo work. Star maps, McCall guessed. The realms and worlds they had made shift between. They turned to look at him with augmetic eyes.
"What do you want, soldier?"
one spat, using a formal construction that emphasized disdain.
"That his voice may never fade. I apologize, my Magirs," he replied, throwing the Sekite salute.
They returned it, grudgingly, glaring down at him.
"My Magirs, Itagawa Karain extends his respects," said McCall, trying to use the awkward construction of formal deference.
He began to sweat. This had been a bad idea. His command of the Sekite tongue was nothing like fluent enough to handle a strange accent and odd word orders of the Veduak subdialect.
"Itagawa Karain wishes to express his concerns that the strenuous work here may disturb the oratory."
"How?"
asked one.
"We would not risk disturbing the Magir who speaks,"
the other exclaimed.
"I merely express the concern, my Magirs," McCall said. "The noise and commotion."
One of the Veduak sneered at him.
"The oratory is two decks hence, soldier,"
he said.
"It would not be possible for us to interrupt the solace of the Magir who speaks."
Two decks in which direction? McCall wondered.
"Begone,"
said one of the Veduak,
"and tell your Itagawa he is a weeping sore."
"I will at once, my Magirs,"
said McCall, backing away. He retraced his steps through the work area. The Veduak had given him little, but the risk had been worth it. He had spotted something over their shoulders while they had been insulting him. He passed a row of spoil bins that were packed with scrap plate and insulation materials. Without breaking stride, he dropped one of the grenades from the Sirdar's weapons belt into it. Red dot. He hoped that meant smoke. It did. In seconds, thick red signal smoke was pouring out of the spoil bin. He hurried back to the Veduak.
"What now, you Alsa?"
one roared. "My Magyars," McCall said, pointing. "A fire in the waste tubs. Something has caught alight." Snorting with anger and surprise, the Vedowag pushed past him. Smoke was now clogging the back of the workspace. He heard them shout for extinguishers and begin to reprimand the servitors for using their fusing torches too close to scrap insulate. With their backs turned, McCall stepped into the supervision post, snatched up the folded sheet of schematics he had seen lying on the table, and vanished entirely into the shadows.
"What did you get?" asked Milo.
McCall took out the thick fold of paper, and they opened it out.
"Deck plans," he said.
They were hand-drawn, a top plan and side elevation, and the work had been done with great skill. The ghostly traceries of the penmanship even revealed the intricate lines of principal power relays and coolant systems.
"They were using it to supervise the repair work," he said.
"No cogitators? No data slates?"
Mazo asked.
"They don't trust digital records," McCall replied.
"I think we can put it to better use," said Milo,
and began to study it carefully.
"I have a question first," said McCall.
"Where the Feth is Holofernes?"
The hot, dark confines of the duct opened out into a long rock creek gallery. It was 160 meters long and 30 wide, an artificial ravine lit by the lambent glow of thick biolume algae. Steeply sloped rock creek walls splayed out from the central channel to form high and narrow overlooked ledges that could be used as inspection walkways. By the phosphorescent light, Obel noted the large and heat-eroded stencil Hall 7816 on one of the rock creek revetments. The channel bed running between the high sloped banks was a mess of fused magmatic spoil through which ran a trickle of foul, liquefied waste. The air stank.
"This is a better site for an ambush," Zakova remarked.
Obel nodded. Meeting the archenemy in the geotherm duct would have been a slaughter. The duct was only wide enough for two people, side by side. They needed room to deploy so they could bring more of their force to bear against a physically superior enemy. Creed assessed the chamber quickly. It had clearly once served as an overpressure gallery to regulate geothermic flow at times of peak output. The remnants of huge ceramite gates stood halfway down the gallery. They had long since fused to immobility, but their purpose had been to stem or even shut off magmatic flow and geothermal pressure. Odesh's geothermic system was thousands of years old. Long ago it had been a subtle system, expertly managed and regulated by dynast technicians who could acutely gauge, direct, and govern the natural power. Those delicate archaeotech mechanisms had long since fallen into disuse. Now Erdesh's power grid was an open network of tunnels that either fed or did not. Power modulation was done by the individual sites, the forces and facilities like EM-14, that tapped into it. But this now-defunct gallery had advantages. More space. More range. There was cover at their end, and further cover and firing positions provided by the open gates and the high rock-crete ledges. Creed could see the open mouth of the duct at the opposite end. That's where they'd be coming from. It was the only vent out of the duct network serving the Gnosis repository area. That is, she hoped it was. If the adepts had lied to Pasha, if Zakova had read the plan wrong, if there was another redundant and disused spur they didn't know about.
"They've got to be close," she said to Obel. "Let's make it here. It's the best option we've seen."
"The only option," said Larkin.
Obel threw quick hand signs. "Defensive positions, here." The ghost squads behind them began to fan out into the gallery, taking up firing positions around the duck mouth, using the ends of the rock creek revetments as cover. Maquette and Boaz set up the .20. Lugging the support weapon and its firing stand all the way from the turbine hall had left them almost dead on their feet from heat exhaustion. Other squad members had carried the ammo boxes. Falkarin and Kleb prepped the two satchels of tube charges, and Ifan handed the primary sticks out. In the tight confines of the chamber, explosives would be a last resort, and Creed made sure everyone understood that. Lubber checked his flamer.
"Keep it tight in here," Obel advised. "Backwash could cook our own people, especially if they're up on the overlooks."
Lubber nodded. He lacked Ongus Brostin's gleeful love of fire, but he understood flames and flamers. He'd been a flame trooper since he joined the regiment, and Larkin had once described him as Brostin without the, you know, not-so-pyro aspects.
Jed Lubber was a big man. Most flame troopers were. It took bulk and core strength to heft a full-size flamer unit around all day. He was sweating profusely, his jacket off, his vest dark with sweat.
"Nice and tight, sir," he promised.
Larkin and O'Kane clambered up the moulded footholds at the end of the revetments to reach the inspection walk, one on each side.
"Firth, it's high," Larkin complained once he was up.
"Quiet," said Creed.
"And narrow," Larkin added.
He eased his way along, carrying his precious longlass carefully, and took up position at the top of the left-hand gate, in among the rusted gears that had once opened and closed it. O'Kane had already set up on top of the right-hand gate. Other ghosts clambered up after them, taking up precarious firing positions along the ledges, some on their bellies. Obel wanted to maximize the number of guns they could bring to bear. Max and Zukova picked their way along the channel, heading down to scout the remainder of the gallery and listen at the far end duct.
"This is recovery," Obel said quietly to Creed.
"This is stopping them," she replied.
"But they're carrying the things," said Obel.
"Gaunt wants the things, right?" She nodded.
"But he doesn't want the bastards to have them. So if it comes to a choice, better no one gets them than they do."
Lunny Obel didn't look sure.
"Pasha didn't specify," he said.
"I don't think she knows either," said Creed. "Our orders were to secure and recover. That idea went up the wall. So now it's recover or deny.
Look," she dropped her voice low and turned him aside.
"Honest to throne, I don't rate our chances here. Just 31 of us. No support? These hostiles were cutting through Skitari 15 minutes ago. We'll be lucky to hold them. If we're really lucky, we smoke them. Just pour it on. If there's anything to recover after that, hooray for us. Bottom line, they don't get past us with the stuff unless we're all dead."
"These things are important, aren't they?" Obel said. "These Eagle Stone things."
"Fifth knows why," she replied. "But yes, clearly. They've sent in elites to get them. So, if we have to destroy them to stop them taking them, so be it."
Obel shook his head.
"Hey,"
she said, nudging him.
"Come on, Lani. They've sent in elites.
Gaunt's sent us.
The Lord Executor, no less.
So what does that make us?"
"Elites?" Obel asked with a tired grin.
"No," she said. "It makes us suckers and lasbait. But at least I made you smile."
"Feth, you toner," he chuckled.
"Sir," Sergeant Ifan hissed. O'Kane was hand-signing from his position. Mags and Zukova were returning down the channel. They were moving fast, dodging and sprinting along the dirty, uneven bed of the gully. "Primary order," Obel signed. Korod raised his hand, and the Kimura halted. He peered ahead at a pale disk that showed where the duct opened into some grander chamber. He looked at the detailed plans Ordnance Yan Yerik had given him. Haklor glanced at him.
"Damagawa."
"We're approaching the gallery," he said.
Haklor nodded. He remembered it from the way in.
"If they're smart and diligent, this is where they'll try to stop us."
"Yes?"
"It's the point I'd choose,"
Korod said. He looked at the chart again.
"Wide enough to deploy, tight enough to defend."
"I doubt our Imperial foe has the wit or ability to get a force down here fast enough,"
said Haklor.
"And that is why we have been at war with them forever,"
said Korod.
"That sort of thinking. We underestimate them. Our foe is smart and diligent. They sent soldiers to recover the stones. They wouldn't have sent just anybody. Special troops. Trustworthy elites."
Haklor nodded, chastised. Korod looked back at the duct mouth. He squinted, his neon-bright eyes searching. The vents were dulling his reworked senses badly. The mucosal resin excreted to protect his lungs from heat burn was clogging his normally hyper-sharp gifts of smell and taste, and the general heat elevation was making it hard for his eyes to detect human heat tracks. But he could hear the soft but urgent drumming of human hearts, elevated with tension, the skitter of loose stones,
the clink of metal as clips were gently slotted into receivers.
"They are there," he said.
"We cannot go back," said Ulro. "They will have secured the other end by now."
"I said nothing about going back," replied Korod. "We are Kimura, brothers. We ascend always. We follow the song of his voice."
"We rush them?" asked Haklor.
"Yes," said Korod. "We will lose some. That is the price. But they will not be prepared for our speed or our fortitude. Remember why our Magir wrought us thus."
Haklor nodded. The Imperial preference for energy weapons, especially the Laz form, had influenced the ritual evolution of the Kimura. The Ingenians of the Heritor College had given earlier generations of their kind the ability to grow hard-shell plates to absorb solid kinetic munitions. That had been back in the dim times of the first human wars. Now Kimura were made to exude the resin coat that sloughed away energy fire. The Ingenians had developed the idea from the study of Loxatl biomechanics. Laz weapons were excellent tools against human flesh. But the Kimura, while not invulnerable, were far more than that.
"You remember the plan of the chamber?" he asked.
The Kimura nodded.
"Haklor, take your warriors and scale the left side. Geraint, yours to the right. Ekir, charge the gully."
All the Kimura hissed assent. They waited for a moment, neon light crisping in their eyes, as what once had been their sweat glands released more mucus to thicken the glistening coating of their flesh. Haklor, Geraint, and the warriors who would accompany them took off their boots. They focused with grimacing concentration, ignoring the pain, as they reworked to lengthen the talons on their fingers and toes. The chitin sprouted, cracking and growing, becoming ugly grey hooks. Korod settled the old guard-issue mazet bag on his shoulder. It contained four of the stones. Ulror had the other four secure in his satchel.
"These get through," said Korod. "That is all that matters. If I fall, if Ulror falls, someone takes up the burden."
"Yes, Magir," they whispered.
"Now let us show this human filth how Kimura fight," said Korod. "For the Anarch who is Sek, whose voice drowns out all others."
It had been still and quiet for several minutes. The waiting tugged at Larkin's nerves. He kept his eyes on the mouth of the duct, but had sighted his longlaz at a rock in the channel bed some 30 meters in. That was a point nothing would cross without taking a headshot. His mazet bag was open at his hip, restocks of overcharged cells ready to grab. "Come on, then. Let's be having you." Creed glanced at Obel. Sweat was running down his cheeks and neck, and it wasn't just the merciless heat of the vent system.
"Movement!"
Zakova hissed. Silently, without battle cry or howl, the Kimura burst from the duct and came at them. The first glimpse of their enemy made the ghosts flinch. They were inhuman. Tall as Ogryn, thin as corpses, sprinting from the duct with astonishing stride length, almost springing like bipedal game bucks. Their speed was the second shock. How could anything move so fast? Creed felt fear flood through her. The enemy had flung themselves forwards to attack. They had known it was an ambush, a prepared position, yet still they had charged. The Kimura bore in like a tide, like a cavalry charge, flowing down the channel, firing their las weapons from the shoulder. The first shots, the cracks echoing around the enclosed space, grazed and chipped the shoulders of the rock-crete revetment. Then the first two ghosts dropped, knocked off their feet by inconceivably accurate strikes.
"Fire!"
Obel yelled. The Tanith guns began to blaze. A blizzard of lasfire ripped down the rock-crete ravine, countercut by fire from the overlooking ledges. Boaz opened up with a .20, pumping streams of rounds down the channel. The noise was painful. The leading Kimura buckled and fell. Those behind leapt over the fallen, firing. Some of the creatures struck down, got up, and began to run again.
"Feth this," whispered Larkin.
They'd outrun his preset sighting point before he'd even squeezed off a shot. Where the feth were they going? He fired, and the longlaz barked.
A Kimura toppled as his skull exploded. His forward momentum kept his corpse tumbling and cartwheeling for several meters. Larkin didn't stop to enjoy his kill. He slammed in another cell and put a second hotshot into the face of another of the neon-eyed fiends. Arcane had opened up too. The two snipers had dropped five of the creatures before the front of the charge had reached the rusted gates. The overcharged hotshots had true stopping power. Not even Kimura biodefenses could block or soak up that kind of energy force. The .20 was also taking a toll. The streams of heavy, hard rounds were shattering limbs and shearing bodies apart. They can't get past this, Obel thought. Doesn't matter what they are, doesn't matter how fast they are, they can't run this kill box. None of them are going to make it to us alive. But the bulk of the Tanith firepower wasn't the heavy crew-served or the two long-las weapons. It was standard las rifles. Hits from them made Kimura stumble and falter. Some fell, others took visible damage. But they kept going. They soaked it up. Obel wondered how many times he'd have to hit the same target spot before he did any lethal damage. The Kimura came on. Their weapons were basic, but their supple, strong bodies allowed them to fire on the move with great accuracy, and las weapons were excellent tools against human flesh. Four ghosts were down. Five. Six. Boaz was hit in the throat and arm and flopped back from the .20, which chattered into silence. Ifan leapt in to take over, but the .20 had feed jammed when Boaz lurched away from the tripod. He fought to unblock the receiver.
"Clear it! Clear it!" Obel yelled.
Larkin heard O'Kane scream out. Two more groups of the enemy were pouring up the revetments onto the ledge. They didn't have to balance. Hooked claws on their feet and hands bit into the crumbling crete like pitons. Some were almost running along the walls on all fours like human spiders. Larkin and O'Kane switched aim. They no longer had time to fire at the charging tide below. They began sighting over the gate mechanisms to fend off the horrors that were racing along the walls at their level. O'Kane hit one, and the kill shot hurled the scurrying scarecrow shape off the ledge, spinning and flailing. Larkin blew the head off the first one coming at him, then reloaded to greet the second. On the far side, O'Kane missed with his third shot. Hacklaw vaulted over the corroded gears of the gate and decapitated O'Kane with a slash of his foreclaws. Down below, Mag saw O'Kane perish.
"On the walls! They're up on the walls!" he yelled.
Several of the ghosts at the ducked mouth tried to angle up and fire at the Kimura advancing along the edges. This further reduced the firepower, concentrating on the main charge. Hacklaw and two others had swept past O'Kane's station, sending his corpse tumbling down the revetment, and fell into the ghosts positioned on the ledge. The ghosts tried to fight back, shooting point-blank at the unexpected attack, or trying to fend off the Kimura with rifle butts or blades. The Kimura killed some outright with their meat-hook claws, or simply threw the troopers off the ledge into the channel below, a drop that either killed or crippled them as they hit the Rock Creek gully below. Ifan got the .20 cleared, but the front end of the charge was already on them. The Kimura had left many of their kin dead and mangled in the Rock Creek channel behind them, but with undimmed fury and unfaltering speed, the remainder of the reworked warriors swept into the ghosts' fragile line. Chapter 17. Flesh is Weak. There was no quarter, no room to move, no time to think. The twilight gallery shook with gunfire, stray las rounds spitting through the fug of accumulated smoke. The leading Kimura hit the line, taking shots point blank, shredding and dying, and soaking up damage for the warriors behind them. The ghosts had fixed silver and resorted to stabbing and thrusting as the Kimura swept into them. Most were simply bowled backwards by the superior power and force of the arch-enemy creatures. Even with bayonets driven deep into blistered neon flesh, they were carried over or dragged backwards. Some were crushed underfoot, others fell to raking claws or sprays of shot. Korod was in the thick of it, tearing his way forwards. He had known since setting out that many of his kind would not return from the mission. One did not enter the heartland of the enemy and expect to survive unscathed. The holy work was all that mattered. The orders of the voice. The Kimura could be remade. New and worthy sons could be blessed and reworked to replace the fallen. They would all share the same eternal purpose, to prevail, even to the last of them.
and they would prevail. They would break all opposition and bear the keys of victory to his side, and lay them at his feet, even if they were reduced to just a handful, to just one. Never had so many of the Kimura been deployed together, and never had so many perished in the same action. It was a mark of honor, a mark of trust. Their very losses, unthinkable in extent, proved the magnitude of their task. Victory, no more, no less. Ultimate victory in the Sabbat War. A few meters of filthy ground in a rock creek channel. A few outclassed enemy soldiers in their path. That was all that stood in the Anarch's way. A few meters. A few bags of human meat. The Kimura could conquer that. The Imperials had fought well. Where they lacked strength, they had compensated with wit and diligence. They had executed to effect. They had shown courage and resolve, and tactical skill. And now they would die, because their unworked bodies were too fragile to sustain the effort, their weapons too weak. At the last moment, which was always the only moment that truly mattered, their strength could not match their determination. He could see the looming mouth of the duct behind them.
"Flamer!"
Obel yelled into the carnage. The .20 was overrun. Everything was just smoke and blood and jarring impacts and crashing bodies. Lubba stood his ground and sent a lance of sucking, roaring white heat into the first of the Kimura, searing flesh from bone. The superheated stream annihilated one entirely, scattering fused and burning fragments of bone. Another managed to stagger a few steps, skinless and ablaze, before falling. Creed and Obel tossed their rifles aside and pulled the Adept Warden's staves out of their shoulder packs. They stood their ground and fired. The air distorted as grav pulses blasted from the ends of the staves. The next two Kimura fell back, their skulls crushed like eggs. Creed and Obel tried to fire again, but the Mechanicus weapons took a moment to cycle. And there were no more moments.
"Lenny!" Creed yelled. "Charges, now!" Obel roared.
On the ledge, Larkin heard Obel's distant order as he scrambled back from the gate. A Kimura bounded over it, dropping onto him. For a second, he locked eyes with the thing's neon gaze. Then he met it with his silver. The Kimura landed and impaled itself on the Tanith blade, locked to the end of Larkin's long las. It writhed, pulling on the long gun, threatening to wrench it out of the old marksman's hands or roll them both off the ledge. Larkin pulled the trigger. The hot shot blew the Kimura in half and hurled the sectioned creature off his blade. Another Kimura came over the gate gears behind it. Larkin reached for his reload bag, but quick as he was, there wasn't going to be enough time. Hands grabbed him from behind and shoved him down onto his face. Wes Maggs was kneeling on his back, hosing rapid fire at the oncoming Kimura. Trooper Galashia was behind him, lighting it up over Maggs's head. The combined fire swatted the Kimura off the ledge. It plunged towards the channel below just as the ghost's explosives began to go off. Tube charges and grenades were the only things they had left. The dwindling line of ghosts was being crushed back into the mouth of the gallery. At Obel's order, they had frantically hurled their tube charges and whatever grenades they were carrying. The staggered blasts lit up along the ghost's end of the chamber, filling the artificial ravine with a sudden forest of explosions. It was a desperate choice, a final choice. Many of the Kimura were blown apart instantly, but the blast pressure was trapped and channeled. The rock-creek ravine cupped and focused the overshock and drove it up and out. The ghosts defending the duckmouth were hurled off their feet by the hammering wave, rolling and tumbling, deaf, dazed and blind. The overpressure scorched up the revetments too. It swept Maggs off the ledge. Larkin and Galashia managed to grab him before he fell and clung on desperately as he tried to drag himself up again, his feet swinging over the drop. Smoke and flames boiled down the gully, dense and caustic. Creed tried to rise. She saw a Kimura almost on her and fired her stave. The gravity round hammered him back into the revetment wall and split his torso like a ripe ploin. The Kimura had a guard-issue satchel over one shoulder. It slumped along with his corpse into the filth of the channel bed. Korod saw Ulrohr die.
"Take it up! Take it up!" he yelled.
He saw Drehek stumble out of the swirling, spark-filled smoke, casting aside an Imperial he'd just gutted with his claws. Drehek saw the fallen treasure and ran for it. He pulled it off Ulrohr's corpse and turned. A javelin of white-hot fire raked him and torched him. The Kimura and the satchel collapsed in a consuming ball of flame. Korod howled. There was no time to go back, no time to recover what was lost. He still had four of the stones. He threw himself on, the duct ahead. An Imperial blocked his path. He smashed the man aside, snapping his neck and removing half of his face. Zhukova, deafened by the bombs, saw the monster kill Gansky. She fired full auto, cutting Korod off his feet with a hail of Laz. Korod rose, his skin blistered and smouldering. She hit him with another burst. He fell, then came at her. She hit him again and saw neon blood spurt and spatter. He was centimeters from her when his head wrenched sideways. The side of his skull caved in and burst. Korod fell. Lunny Obel lowered the stave. "These feathers just don't know when to die, do they?" he asked. A hunched, stumbling figure slammed into Obel from behind and knocked him aside. Hacklaw, wounded and disfigured, and perhaps the last Kimura left alive, was still going. His claws tore the Maset bag from his Damagawa's corpse. Clutching it to his chest, he plunged into the duct. Chiria offered Colossim the detonator casually, the way a trooper might offer a comrade a pack of low sticks.
"You wired it," Ferdy Colossim replied. "You do the honors."
Chiria shrugged. The scars on her face crinkled with a grin of relish.
"Ghosts, ghosts," she said into her bead. "Stand by for death. Brace and ease."
It had just begun to rain again. Fine sheets of drizzle washed across the approach to EM-14. The ghosts huddled in the darkness, braced, and opened their mouths to prevent burst eardrums. Chiria flipped off the switch guard and pressed the detonator stud. There was a light flash, and then a shock that they all felt in their lungs and bones. Then a boom split the night in half. A sheet of flame ripped across the front of the Mechanicor fortress. Huge chunks of rockcrete and oozelite came tumbling out, crunching like a landslip across the apron. The blast shock flattened the security fences, tearing the chain link apart, and blew in the back of the guardhouse. As the concussion dropped, pebbles, grit, and flecks of stone began to fall with the rain.
"Get into it!" Colossim ordered.
The chosen tactical squads hurried from cover, weapons ready. Debris was still fluttering down. Smoke blanketed the site, and numerous fires were burning. The Mechanicor's main gate zone was a mass of broken slag and buckled rebar. The huge blast doors themselves were still entirely intact. They were simply lying on the ground.
"Nice job," Colossim commented as he clambered over the rubble on the heels of the point team.
Chiria followed, lugging her short-snout rig and ammo hopper.
"I knew a truckload of Hayex would have its uses, sir," she replied.
Needs must, Colossim thought. Bray and Armin had spent almost 20 minutes trying to cut an entry in the main doors. The cult Mechanicus built things to last, and on top of that, EM-14's systems had suffered a catastrophic collapse, so there had been no joy trying to rewire the circuits either. Colossim had been urgently considering other potential entry points when Chiria had tapped him on the shoulder and simply pointed to the bomb truck that the Sekites had tried to drive into their lines. He had said,
"Oh, what the faith. Breach it."
The point team slithered and climbed in over the rubble, moving through the heavy haze of smoke and dust with weapons up and sweeping. Primary lights and environment were down, but self-powered auxiliary lumen banks had come on, illuminating the interior hall with a soft blue glow. Bray had tack lead. He threw hand signs, fanning his entry team wide. They left the edge of the rubble and the blast area and crossed a marble floor covered with inblown grit and lumps of rockcrete. The ghosts moved from pillar to pillar, bounding cover. Vadim's squad moved in at their heels, then Colossim with the heavier weapons. Colossim signaled his own squad wide, then moved up to join Bray and Keoba. The hall ahead was large and silent, a long chamber like the nave of a temple. Backwashed smoke from the entry blast was collecting in the high ceiling space. Colossim looked around. A fight had torn through here in the last hour or so. The walls and floor were scarred with bullet and las strikes. He saw several Mechanicus weapon servitors, dead and blown out, plus the bodies of half a dozen Tanith troopers. It must have been hell, trapped in here when the machines turned. Keoba pointed. Several of the automata had been shot out and wrecked, but several others seemed intact. They had just shut down and died. Colossim edged closer to one and inspected it. Black goo, like treacle, was seeping out of its casing. It had burned out from within,
its cogitator and biomech processors dissolving into mush.
Like the thing outside, Bray remarked.
Same here, sir,
called Vadim. He was examining systems built into a wall, a data duct and a row of monitor screens. Tarry black slime oozed from all of them.
Colossim to Arcuda, Colossim said into his bead.
Entry achieved.
Copy,
Arcuda's voice replied.
I thought I heard you knock.
Arcuda had taken charge of the companies inside the Mechanicor. Pasha and Elam had already descended into the ducts, and like Obel and Creed's hunter squads, they were out of comm range. Word was, Thais was dead, and he died in the first few minutes. Colossim had warned Arcuda once it had become clear he was only going to force entry by unsubtle means. Arcuda had pulled all ghost forces clear of the entry hall.
Moving in by squad, Colossim said. You still got actives?
It's quietened down a lot, said Arcuda. A few bursts, so watch yourself. But the frenzy is done. I think they're all dead, or dying.
It true about Thais?
Yeah, we've taken a beating. Big purse.
Colossim winced. Big purse. The euphemism stung. The Militarum had bastardized it from Munitorum jargon, an assessment term used in action reports and logistical summaries. Big purse was actually big perk. The cover sheet abbreviation for big percentage casualty rate, indicating 45% losses or higher. To Colossim, it always sounded like some thieving bastard had got away after a brutal mugging.
We need to get Medicaid and Medvac soon as, Arcuda reported.
Working on that, Colossim replied.
Links to High Command and Eltath operations are still down.
Another big hit? Arcuda asked.
Can't say. Hoping it's just technical feth. But shit's kicking off all over town.
No way the palace has been hit, said Arcuda.
You'd think, Colossim agreed.
The teams moved forwards again. Colossim stuck tight with Vadim and Keober.
What's the plan? Colossim asked into his bead.
Do we start extraction?
Kasvak, yes, soon as you can, Arcuda replied. But otherwise we secured the Feth out of this place. The operation's still live down in the ducts. No signal yet, but we need to be ready to support, or block anything that tries to come out.
Copy that. Key me in.
We've covered all the possible duct exits, replied Arcuda, but we haven't reached Turbine Hall 1 yet. That's where Creed and Lani went in. That's closer to you.
On it, said Colossim.
We'll lock that up.
He followed the advance in. More automata wrecks. Dead tech priests and adepts, some of whom had been shot apart or torn limb from limb. The Mechanicus had turned on itself, as well as its guests. Black slime spattered the floor and was sprayed up some walls. Most of it leaked from the machine dead, but some of it was oozing and dripping from the building itself. There were more dead ghosts, too. Men and women Colossim knew well, lying where they had fallen, buckled and twisted. Some had died instantly from massive wound trauma. Others had died slowly, alone and in pain, caught in the open. Blood trails demonstrated that.
Fifth this, Vadim muttered.
How do we know they're dead? Bray asked.
Throne, look at them, Colossim replied.
Not ours, sir, said Bray. The cult mech.
Colossim hesitated.
Feth of a time to think that thought.
They looked dead. Servitors and priests, cold and still, leaking black shit onto the floor. They'd been infected by something. But they had never been alive in the first place. Not in ways Colossim or his ghosts understood. Cult Mechanicus were pretty cold and still at the best of times. How could he tell? The shot-up ones, sure. But the others? They knew a frenzy had overtaken them, a killing bloodlust. Then they'd shut down and dropped, spewing the black goop everywhere. Was that death? Or was it just another phase? Inertia, a dormant state while the infection progressed to the next stage. Colossim looked around and swallowed nervously. There were hundreds of dead cult mech personnel and servitors littering the halls and arcades. He could see 40 alone from where he was standing. What if they were about to come back? Switch the Feth back on? Wake up and resume their kill frenzy? He'd just walked 2 full companies in amongst them.
Feth, he breathed.
What?
Keober asked. Colossim fumbled for his bead.
Colossim to all entry teams. I want confirmed taps on every mech body you see. Repeat, kill confirm every potential hostile. No exceptions.
His team leaders voxed affirmative. The shots started. The men around him spread out, aiming down at the heads or central processors of every dead adept, priest, and servitor, and firing a point-blank round to destroy them. It was grim work. It was vital work. The Mechanicus kept its mysteries and secrets to itself. If there was even a slim chance any of them would revive, it had to be erased. Obel clambered to his feet and stumbled towards the duct. Creed and Zukova had already taken off into the vent in pursuit of the fleeing Kimura.
"Tona!" he yelled.
There was no reply. He felt woozy, his lungs tight from the heat. The thing had hit him hard, and he was pretty sure he was carrying broken ribs, or worse. But the adrenaline surge of the savage fight was still pumping through him. He glanced back at the devastation behind him. Smoke virtually filled the gallery's rock-crete ravine, and fires were burning where both bodies and the chemical silt in the channel bed had caught. The enemy dead choked the gully mouth, and the Tanith dead and injured were all around him.
"Sergeant!" he yelled.
Ifan limped to him, gashes on his face.
"Sir?" "Check the dead. The enemy dead. None of these bastards can be alive. You understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then see to our wounded. Come on, Ifan. Rally whoever's left."
Ifan nodded.
Where will you be, sir?" he asked.
Obel was already hurrying towards the vent. Tona Creed was a strong runner, but Zukova was staying with her. The heat in the close confines of the vent was intense. Creed wasn't sure how much longer either of them would last before dehydration shock or the stifling air overcame them. She wasn't going to let the bastard go. And there were very few places he could go. This was the main vent spur, the route they'd followed to get in. It ran all the way out beyond the limit of the EM-14 site, and eventually joined the main geotherm shaft. No divisions, no sub-tunnels. At least, that was what the chart had seemed to show. 2 kilometers out to the main magmatic pipeway. The heat was bad enough. The noxious volcanic gases were burning her throat and binding her chest, as though her respiratory system was corroding. The duct was a tube, and the base was littered with magmatic residue and liquid spoil, making it treacherous underfoot. She twisted her ankle twice, and then stumbled so badly she fell and slammed painfully into the curved wall of the duct. Zukova pulled her up.
"We can't," Zukova began.
"We can,"
Creed insisted. It had been easier coming in, despite the weight of gear. They'd moved steadily, picking their way. Nothing like this blind, headlong rush, chasing down a pipe into hell after one of its demons. They started to run again. Zukova had strapped her rifle over her back. Creed's rifle was back in the gallery, but she still had the Mechanicus stave.
"He was hurt," Zukova said, coughing. "So are we. No, he was wounded. I don't care how inhuman he was damaged."
Creed knew she was right. She'd seen the Kimura go past her, torso and arm torn and blistered from weapons fire. She'd seen splashes of yellow fluid on the wall of the duct as they rushed into it. Maybe that was their only edge. Maybe they could overtake him, despite his speed, because he'd start to flag as his wounds slowed him. She saw a vertical beam of pale light ahead. It was the down duct that led back to Turbine Hall 1, the one they'd lugged the support weapons and ammo down, rung by rung. She ran straight under the opening and kept going.
"Tona!"
Zukova called. Creed looked back.
"Not that way!" "He might have..." "No, he's gone out the same way he went in, right down to the main thermal line, Zukova. That just goes back up into the Mechanicore."
"But..."
"Come on!"
Creed turned and started running again.
"Captain Creed!"
Zukova yelled. Creed cursed and swung back around.
"What?"
Zukova was standing under the ceiling duct, looking up.
"What, Zukova?" "He would have gone up," Zukova said, "if it was the easy way."
Creed stumbled back to her, panting.
"What?"
she asked.
"If he was wounded," said Zukova, "desperate, knew he couldn't make it all the way to the main line, decided to hide."
Creed looked at her.
"Is that a guess? Are you guessing?" "I'm trying to think as he might think," Zukova replied. "I don't think I can go much further. Not all the way along. And then how many more kilometers to get out of the city, the clave zones, back to enemy lines? If I was hurt, I'd hide. And this is the only hiding place. The only one."
Creed glared at her.
Zhukova reached up and grabbed the lowest rung of the service ladder. She hauled her way up a short distance into the base of the downshaft. She paused and dragged her hand along the next rung up, then looked down at Creed and showed her palm. It was smeared with yellow fluid.
"The bastard went up," she said.
"Feth," Creed growled. "Jump down. Jump the Feth down on Ella."
Zhukova landed beside her. Creed raised the stave, aimed it up the downshaft, and loosed a pulse of rippling gravitron force. They heard it strike something in the darkness far above, a dull, metallic thump. Dust, pebbles, and flakes of rusted metal showered down on them. Creed pushed the stave into her pack and grabbed the lower rungs, heaving herself up. Obel ran up, panting and coughing from the duct behind them.
"Creed, where the feth are you going?" he gasped.
"Up," Creed yelled, disappearing from view. Zhukova looked at Obel.
"Because he did," she said.
"Is it dead?" he asked. The Beatty Sabbat sighed. Gaunt had never seen her look so exhausted. Even the soft inner light she seemed to generate had dimmed.
"Yes," she said.
The billet hall of the Undercroft was just a billet hall. All the reality distortions had vanished like dreams. The flood water had drained away swiftly, leaving only foul puddles and debris on the flagstones. Baskerville's men were lighting lamps, so there was a little light at least. Gaunt slowly looked around. Just a cellar now. Cold, damp, damaged, old. Just a place, a solid, ordinary reality, a set of deep chambers no one cared about. The malice that had infused the stones had fled with the woe machine's death shock. The Undercroft had realigned with reality and returned to what it had always been. Gaunt checked himself. No. The place had changed forever. No one would come here now. It ought to be sealed, not because there was some lingering trace of immaterial evil, but because of what it was. A tomb. A scene of murder. A sight so burdened with grief and loss, it was hard to even stand there. The dead littered the ground between wastewater puddles and broken cots. Sancto's men. Oscar was moving from body to body, checking for life, though it was just a formality. They had been cut to ribbons. Sariadzi had been destroyed so completely, no trace of him remained. Gaunt wondered how many others had died here. Ghosts, men and women of the retinue, so devoured by the darkness that nothing had survived to show they had ever existed. Dower sat in a corner, his back to the wall. This loss, this slaughter, had scarred them all. Gaunt doubted he would ever see Ban Dower flash his eager smile again. And then there was Gol. Kolia was sitting on the ground, staring at the spot where Yonsi had been. Only a few fused black thorns remained, like a scatter of dead leaves. There was no expression on his face. Gaunt couldn't begin to know what Gol Kolia was feeling, except that part of him was afraid he could. Merity had been down here. She'd been caught in this. Gaunt barely knew her, and what little he did know was lies. In truth, he hadn't known his daughter any better than Gol had known his. But the damage was primal. It defied rationalization. A child was a child, no matter how estranged, no matter how false. Dallin Creed stood apart from the rest, leaning against a wall, staring at the whitewashed stones. His weeping had stopped, and his anguished denials had trailed into silence. Gaunt knew Dallin felt this more bitterly than anyone. Even more than Gol, he had been close to the girl. The conflict had broken him. Grief for the loss of his sister, rage at the sheer depth of the betrayal. Yonsi had never been Yonsi, but that hadn't stopped them from believing she was real. 4 years she had been part of them, part of the Tanith Company, a survivor, a cheerful, quirky girl who had often been a welcome antidote to the grind of war. Caring for her, laughing with her, protecting her, amusing her. That had been part of their lives, simple human interactions that had allowed them to forget, once in a while, the struggle they were committed to. Except she had been the war all along. The war had been dwelling with them, within their ranks, inside their trust, inside their minds and their hearts, waiting to reveal its true nature. This was the greatest wound the ghosts had ever suffered. It had cut the heart of them out, from the inside, striking from the single place that seemed safe. Gaunt had never doubted the devotion of his duty. He had never questioned his belief that man should fight against the ruinous powers with every fiber of his soul. Yesterday he'd wanted the Anarch dead and defeated, just as he had the week before that, and the year before that. But this... Sek would die, not because it was Gaunt's duty, not because it was the right thing, not because it was the Emperor's will, and not because his death would protect mankind. Sek would die because of this. Stab lights bobbed in the archway behind him. Colonel Gray appeared, leading a team of Odeshi troops and palace staff. "My lord?" "See to the survivors," Gaunt said. "Get them out of here." Gray nodded, and his men moved forward, gathering up Sancto, who was bleeding out and could no longer stand or speak, and assisting Hark, who was still supporting the wounded Lakshima. Lakshima looked at Gaunt.
"This area must be purged and sealed, sir,"
she said, her voice frail.
"The entire level."
"It will be."
"I will assign Ordo staff to undertake the purification rituals."
Gaunt nodded. Lakshima turned and allowed Hark to help her limp away. "What is the situation?" Gaunt asked Gray.
"All power and systems in the palace are out, my lord," Gray replied. "Defenses are down, and all comms are non-functional."
"So no word from Rorn?"
"None, sir. There are reports of attacks throughout Eltath. The enemy has made a play."
"I'll be up directly. Does Van Voits have command?"
"He does, sir," said Gray. "He began evacuation, but then the power crashed. I believe he is working to restore the palace and war room to combat function as quickly as possible."
"We need it." Gray nodded. He saluted and turned to go, then looked at Gaunt again.
"My lord," he said, "your daughter is safe. I had her taken to a Medicaid station just 20 minutes ago."
Gaunt found he could not reply.
"She was shaken, sir, but essentially unharmed. I'll request further reports. I would say she acquitted herself well, braved the ordeal with great composure."
"Thank you, Colonel," said Gaunt. Gray made the sign of the Aquila and hurried off to oversee the recovery efforts. Gaunt had never, in his entire life, felt more like weeping. He looked at Gull, seated, silent, staring, and registered a stab of guilt at his own selfish relief.
"Are you all right?"
asked Kurth.
"Yes," he said. "Ibram," she said in a low voice, "this is something... this is... Throne, I don't know. None of us will just walk away from this. It won't just heal like a battle wound. And even when it does, it won't be a scar any of us wear with any pride. And Gaul, and Ban, and poor Dalin."
"I know," he said. He hugged her quickly, to her surprise, then let her go.
"I wonder," he said, "Anna, I was thinking, I might be forced to step down." "As Lord Executor?" she asked.
He nodded.
"No one would question it," she said. "This trauma, it would break any."
"No," he said. "I think I might step down because Makaroth will never permit his Lord Executor to lead a vengeance strike in person."
"Against Sek?"
"Wherever he is, yes. He dies for this. For this, above and beyond any part of his heinous catalogue of crimes."
"Don't be rash," she said. "Bram?
Bram, listen. You can do more against him as Lord Executor than as an Avenger.
This is what he wants. It's the spite he uses to snap us. He weakens us by striking at our souls. He wants to break you. And if you step down, he will have succeeded."
She gripped his arm and stared into his eyes. Only she, it seemed, was not afraid to look into his eyes.
"Sek doesn't feel," she said. "He has no humanity. That's why he can do this to us. Don't let him turn your humanity against you. Feel this and use it to help you prosecute this war to victory. Don't squander it on some doomed gesture. You're the Lord Executor. Worlds depend on you. And Sek should be fething afraid."
"Afraid?"
"He's made a mortal enemy even stronger."
There was a clatter. The Beatty's sword, scorched and buckled, had slipped from her hand. Urban rushed to steady her.
"She's passed out!"
Urban cried out. her fire-scarred voice even more of a rasp than usual.
"Help me here!"
Kurth and Gaunt rushed to the saint's side.
"Just exhaustion,"
said Kurth, examining her. Gaunt nodded. The saint had come straight from days of battle at Garapan and Urapan. Her divine strength had already been depleted before they'd even begun. These superhuman efforts in the Undercroft had drained all the reserves she had left.
"I see no major wounds," said Kurth. "But then I don't begin to know how the warp may have wounded her in that fight."
"She is so pale,"
said Urban.
"Her light is gone."
"Get her up," Kurth yelled. "Help me, Osket!" The ghosts from Baskerville's team rushed to her and lifted the Beatty's limp form between them.
"There's no weight to her,"
Osket exclaimed. "This way," Kurth urged them, leading the men towards the exit. The ghosts in black, with their fragile, pale burden, reminded Gaunt of pallbearers. "Anna," he called out. Kurth looked back at him and simply nodded. The look in her eyes told him everything he needed to know. It was the same uncompromising determination he'd seen every time Medicaid Kurth had fought to save a wounded soul on the fields of war they had crossed together. There were very few of them left in the Undercroft now. Dower, Collier, and Dallin, lost in their own pain. Blenner lurking by the door, anxious, as if he was waiting for something. Gaunt was heartened a little to see Blenner show a simple human response of sympathy for once. Baskerville glanced at Gaunt. Shock was etched on his face, too.
"Should we try to move them?"
he asked Gaunt. Gaunt nodded. "Gently," he said. "They should mourn as long as they need to, but this place is..."
"I know, sir,"
Baskerville replied. Gaunt took a step towards Collier, but Baskerville stopped him. Basque and Gull were best friends. Basque would be a more welcome comfort. Gaunt crossed to Dower instead.
"Let's go upstairs, Ban," he said.
Dower looked up at him. He rose and brushed off his coat.
"No," he said.
"No?"
"No, sir."
"Ban,
I haven't found her yet," he said. "I'm not leaving until I have."
"Ban, we can get teams down here. A proper search of all..."
"No,"
Dower said fiercely.
"I'll look. Me."
He walked past Gaunt and disappeared into the neighboring chamber. Gaunt heard Dower calling her name. Haller cut loose with a long burst from the short snout rigged around his body. The link belt from the hopper at his feet clattered as it fed out. Harsh flowers of muzzle flash flickered around the cannon's wide barrel, and spent brass fluttered into the air. The automata, limping and drooling black ooze, punctured in 50 places. Its casing disintegrated, flayed off it by the hail of shells, and it slumped, burning from the core, black fluid pouring from its ruptured innards.
"Still one or two of them active,"
Haller remarked.
"Stay sharp,"
Collisim said. He looked at Bray. The sergeant was trying to force the hatch into Turbine Hall 1. Keober was working with him.
"Any luck?"
Collisim called out.
"Stand by,"
said Bray.
"Are we going to need more shit from that truck?"
Collisim asked.
"No, I've got it," said Bray, working intently. "It's just locked from inside."
Creed and Zukova clambered out of the open duct, weapons ready. Obel limped out behind them. Turbine Hall 1 was just as they'd left it. The huge vapor engines had slowed down to an impotent wheeze. The bodies of the dead, Ghost and Mechanicus alike, lay where they had fallen.
"You were wrong," said Creed.
"No,"
replied Zukova with a firm shake of her head.
"Then where is he?"
Creed edged out across the floor space, picking her way over bodies, watching for any sign of movement. There were plenty of hiding places. So much pipework, bulk machines, consoles. The hostile could have concealed himself. Creed wasn't sure if he'd had a weapon, but if he did, he could be lining up a shot. She crossed to the hatch. It was still locked tight, internal setting, just the way Zukova had sealed it before they had entered the ducts. No one could have exited and locked it again from the inside.
"We went the wrong way," she said.
She was dizzy from the fumes of the duct, dead on her feet from running and climbing.
"He didn't come this way."
"He did,"
Zukova said.
"Then where is he?"
Creed asked.
"Fetting where?"
"Somewhere,"
said Zukova. She prowled across the chamber.
"He's in here. I'll tell you where he is,"
snapped Creed.
"He's 2 kilometers away, heading out into the main thermal pipe. He's home free. We went the wrong fetting way."
"It was just a call, Toner,"
said Obel, sitting down and trying to collect his breath. He was wheezing badly.
We made a call. It was the wrong one.
It wasn't, said Zukova. Then where is he? Creed snarled.
Hiding,
said Zukova. She started to slam open storage lockers along the west wall, aiming her weapon into each as she threw the doors open. Just machine spares, clusters of cables, pipework.
They won, said Creed. They fething won. They got the stones.
The main hatch let out a bang of auto bolts and then slid open with a slow pneumatic hiss. Creed, Obel, and Zukova turned, weapons aimed.
Hold fire! Hold fire!
Bray yelled as he saw them. The ghosts around him lowered their aim and fanned out into the hall.
What happened? Asked Colossim.
Creed just shook her head, exhausted.
We met them coming out, said Obel. Held them. Fething mess of a firefight. Unreal. They weren't human, and they kept coming. Just savage. Big purse. But one got past us.
Just one, said Zukova.
Fething bastard had a bag. Had the stones, said Obel. We went after him, but he got out through the geotherm system.
Oh, Feth, said Colossim.
He didn't go that way,
Zukova insisted. She turned back to her search.
He came this way. Then where? Asked Creed. I told you, said Zukova. He's hiding. In here somewhere. There's nowhere else. That's the first time that hatch has opened. He's in this chamber right now.
Search, top to bottom,
Colossim yelled. Squads of ghosts fanned out, hunting in every alcove, checking the service walks behind machines. Some climbed up onto the inspection gantries. Others stood in a mob by the hatchway, gazing dismally at the dead.
No sign, Bray called.
Other ghosts sang out negatives.
See, said Creed.
I'll try and patch through to Pasha, said Colossim. Tell her the word.
Zukova was still searching. She ducked down to look behind the hall's control desks. Trooper Etzen's corpse was sprawled under the console. He'd been felled by one of the adept warden's grav pulses. The energy had crushed and mangled him. Zukova frowned. The gravitron force was powerful, but it would not have removed Etzen's jacket and cape. She rose.
Shit, she said.
What?
Asked Obel.
Etzen, no cape. No.
Creed and Zukova turned. The bodies of four ghosts had been lying on the floor between the consoles and the hatch. Now there were only three. Creed and Zukova sprang forwards, Obel staggering after them.
What the Feth, Tona?
Colossim exclaimed as Creed pushed past him.
He's just walking out, she yelled.
She had no idea how a rail-thin, two-meter-tall spectre could just walk out, but she knew it had. She and Zukova pushed through the bewildered ghosts standing in the doorway.
Move! Creed yelled at them. Move!
One ghost had detached himself from the back of the group. Draped in his camo cloak, he was limping away across the wide arcade outside, heading for the main exit. He was just walking past the ghost squads stationed in the arcade area. It wasn't her quarry. This man was short, small. He looked old and frail. The cape pulled tight around him. But Creed knew it wasn't any ghost she knew.
You, she yelled. You! Halt!
The ghost kept walking.
Last warning,
Creed yelled. The man paused. He stopped limping. He glanced back at her over his shoulder. He was an old man, weathered and skinny. He looked like one of the scrawny Ayatani priests that had been flooding into the city. He looked straight at her for a second, then turned and kept on going, limping on towards the door. In that one second, Creed had seen the neon glint in his pupils. She fired her stave. The grav pulse thumped out of the projector end. Ghosts scattered and recoiled as the seething mass of distorted air bubbled across the concourse. It hit the limping man in the back, crushing his spine and ribcage, and pulping his internal organs. Hacklaw fell. He died as he had entered the world, his blessed reworking hidden from view. Creed and Zukova reached the corpse. Creed turned it over gingerly with her foot. Just a dead old man, wrapped in a Tanith combat cloak. Zukova knelt down and pulled the dirty Maset bag out of his dead hands. She opened it and gently lifted out one of the four eagle stones.
I take it back, Creed said. You were right. Feather came this way.
They ran through the rain into the drab Rock Creek compounds of the vapor mill beside Camp Xenos. snapshots of Laz whined after them. "Keep moving," Rawn said.
"There's no fifth in cover, sir," said Laidley, glancing around.
The trooper was right, and Rawn knew it. The Plaid Parish vapor mill was a large site, generating power for an entire district of the city. Open-air yards and service ways ran between the rows of blank worksheds and machine shops. The main stacks and primary hall of the mill were ahead. It was an automated facility. There was no one around, and every door or hatch they tried was sealed. Wartime. Blackout protocols. The mill had been locked down. Overhead, masses of white steam oozed from the huge stacks and flowed like a glacier into the night's black sky. Full dark. Rain was blowing in off the wastelands beyond the mill perimeter. It smelled of the physoline lifted by the munition store explosion.
"Just go," Mabon said. "Leave me. I will face them. It will all end then."
Rawn wanted to slap him, but the pain in his gut was getting worse. He gritted his teeth to stop himself from making a sound.
"Shut the feff up," Val said to Mabon. "Just shut up. We lost good people getting you out." "I never asked for that," Mabon replied.
"I won't let them be dead for no reason," said Val.
He sniffed, breathing fast.
"I just won't. I just fetting won't. So shut up about leaving you. Shut up."
Mabon looked away.
"How many left?" asked Oyston.
"Three," said Laidley. "Three, I think."
"What have we got that will put them down?" asked Rawn, finally managing to speak without screaming.
"Launcher, grenades," said Val, brandishing Belvile's weapon.
"Maybe this," said Brostin, indicating the big autogun he'd taken off Oaken. "AP rounds. Not much ammo, though." "Hard rounds are better than energy weapons," said Mabon.
"I'll take anything at this point," said Rawn.
Two las bolts shrieked around a blockhouse nearby. Rawn bundled them forward. Val ran with Mabon, driving him on, the others following, covering the group six with weapons leveled.
"What can we do that they won't expect?" Val asked.
"Turn," said Brostin. "Turn on them. Meet them."
"Feth off," said Oyston.
"No, he's right," said Laidley.
They got in against the wall of a work barn, and he pointed at the sheds and service buildings around them.
"Someone in there, by the steps. Another there. You see, by those tanks, you could get in under the pipework, right there. They come through there, the yard. You'd have a killing ground. Wreck them."
"No," said Rawn. "Suicide."
"Suicide kings, sir," said Laidley.
Rawn glowered at him. Oyston grabbed Rawn's arm.
"Sir."
The pull on his arm made Rawn grunt with pain. She looked at him.
"You all right?"
"Yes, Oyston."
"Sir, are you hit?"
"No." "What did you want?"
She studied his face for a second, questioning, then turned and pointed. About half a kilometre away, on the other side of the mill compound, there was a small light. Oyston handed Rawn the scope, and he took a look.
"Night watchman station," he said.
It made sense. The mill would leave a supervisor on site overnight, even in raid conditions.
"In case something goes wrong?" Oyston said. "A fault in the mill?"
"Then what would he do?"
Rawn glanced at her.
"Call it in," he said. "Call in for service support."
She nodded.
"He'll have a vox, that one," she said. We'd need the Militarum code channels," said Rawn.
"I know them by heart, sir,"
said Oyston. "Learn them off pat every morning." Rawn took her by the face with both hands and smacked a kiss on her brow.
"Go,"
he said.
"Go fast as feth. Think you can make it?"
"Absolutely."
"Call in the feth and cavalry, Oyston," he said. "We'll dig in and slow these bastards down."
She nodded, then surprised him by throwing a formal salute.
"It's been an honour, sir," she said.
"It will be again, you silly bastard. Run!"
She took off into the darkness.
"Right," said Rawn. "Let's slow these feathers down."
He looked back at the yard.
"All right,"
he said. He was having trouble breathing.
"You're right, Eli?"
Val asked.
"Fething fantastic," Rawn replied. "Val, keep going. Keep moving Mabon that way. Just stay with him. Keep him alive."
He looked at Laidley and Brostin.
"Let's fething do this," he said. "Just like Laidley set it out."
"Only two decent firing positions," said Brostin.
I can get in there, said Rorn, pointing. Down by that vent.
That shit's all cover, sir, said Brosten. Go with Val. Two of you are better than one. Keep that feather safe, all right?
I think I'm in charge here, said Rorn.
I think we played to our strengths, said Laidley. Suicide kings. Pitcher cards are high, and you keep your kings back in case you need them late in the game.
I should never have taught you to play, said Rorn.
I should never have joined the Imperial Guard, replied Laidley. We had a choice, asked Brosten.
Rorn looked at them both. Live forever, he said.
They nodded. Brosten lumbered away to the steps of the service shed. Laidley sprinted low across to the heavy feeder tanks. They vanished into the deep shadows, just ghosts, then gone. Rorn stood for a moment, then turned and hurried after Varl and Mabon. He was limping. Every step was a jolt of pain.
Hadrel sniffed the rain. He looked at the others. Sekran, Jagar, just the three of them. More than enough.
They're close, he said.
They'd stripped the resin from their snouts, so their acute senses were as sharp as possible. Jagar nodded.
I smell blood, said Ur. At least one is wounded,
Sekran agreed. Hadrel eyed them. The fight had been fierce. He and Sekran were intact apart from some las burns. Jagar had been hurt in the blast. Swollen crusts of mucus covered part of his face, throat and shoulder.
We're low on munitions, Hadrel said. They have run us quite a game. So, conserve. The Figgoth is the one that counts. Bite out his throat if you have to.
Kah, Magir,
they responded.
He dies, said Hadrel.
He dies,
they echoed. Hadrel gestured, and they moved forwards.
He will regret the day he left us, he said.
Nade Oyston ran through the darkness, following shadows, darting between blank anonymous sheds and silent service huts. The mill compound was larger than it had seemed. The night watch post still looked a million kilometers away, and every shadow made her jump. She kept expecting one of those things, those Kimura, to loom up, to spring out of the darkness. She had her weapon ready, her cut-down riot gun and its bag of breaching shells. Let's see how they like that, she thought. Let's see how much they like a face full of wound titanium shot wire. Oyston touched her face where Rorn had seized her with both hands to kiss her. There was blood on her fingers. She'd known. Just the way he had been moving, holding himself. Always a lying bastard. That look he'd shot her. Say nothing. She turned towards the distant light and started running as fast as she could. There was no sound except the hiss and spatter of the rain. Laidley had his weapon up, covering the middle of the yard. They had to come through here. He had switched to full auto, last cell locked in the receiver. He couldn't see Brosten, but he could see the steps of the service shed. Good bit of shadow. Nice angle for that big auto gun. Brosten would be the hitter on this one. That thing, at short range, with those armor-piercing shells Okel had prized, would make a hole in anything. A waiting game now. Patience. Waiting for the deal. Waiting for the cards to land. Those things moved as quietly as any ghost, but there was an open kill box waiting. Laidley took aim, nice and loose, ready for the snap. Sekran's claws closed around his throat. The Kimura hoisted him off the ground. Laidley tried to scream, but the vicing grip had crushed his throat. Sekran kept squeezing until he'd wrung and snapped the human's neck. As he died, Laidley squeezed the trigger, full auto, aimed at nothing, sprayed out of the swinging gun, tearing into the rock-crete ground of the yard, pinging off the tanks, stitching up the wall. Brosten saw the wild burst, saw the two figures strobe lit by the muzzle flash, one lifting the other by the throat. He yelled Laidley's name, then opened fire. The autogun's big rounds smacked into the feeder tanks. The Kimura tossed Laidley's body aside and ran at Brosten, bringing up his las rifle to fire.
"Yeah, you fethin, come at me,"
Brosten snarled. He put the first armor-piercing hard round through Sekran's face, the second and third through his torso. By then, There was very little left of him above the sternum or between the shoulders. The Kimura folded and collapsed in the middle of the open yard. Brosten switched around, looking for the others. He saw movement and banged off two more shots. On the roof of the machine shop opposite, Hadrill noted the muzzle flashes. He took the grenade out of his jacket pocket and weighed it in his hand. They'd picked over the bodies of the Imperial dead and found a few useful items. He threw it. Brosten heard it strike the gutter above him. He knew the sound of an anti-personnel bomb whacking against metal. He threw himself forward. The grenade splintered the front of the service shed and obliterated the steps. The blast rolled Brosten hard across the rockcrete, and shrapnel wickered into his flesh. He lay for a moment, deaf and dazed. Then he tried to rise. "My turn again, you fethers." The front wall of the wrecked service shed collapsed, and the entire roof gave way. An avalanche of slabs and rockcrete roof tiles buried Ongus Brosten. Dust billowed off the heap of rubble. It was piled up like the rocks of a tribal grave on some lonely hillside. Just one hand protruded, caked in dirt. Hadrill leapt down from the roof and landed on his feet. Jagar emerged from cover and walked to join him. They clutched their las rifles and advanced side by side.
"Just the last of them now," said Hadrill.
"Gol, we have to go up now," Baskerville said gently. "Can't stay down here all night."
Kolia didn't reply. He was staring at the burned thorns.
"Gol, I made a promise," Kolia said at last. "Swore it, Bask." "It was a promise you couldn't keep," said Baskerville. "They don't count." "I should have known."
"None of us knew, Gol." Kolia looked at him.
"I did, though," he said. "I thought it. I considered it. I even took it to Gaunt. I told him what I feared." "I'm sure he..." Baskerville began.
"He reassured me," said Kolia. "He talked me down. Said it was a mistake."
"Nobody could have known the truth," Baskerville said.
He glanced over his shoulder. Gaunt and Blenner were standing a few yards away, watching them. He could see the expression on Gaunt's face. Guilt. Guilt for brushing Kolia's fears aside. They all felt the guilt. Baskerville certainly did. Odd, nagging doubts that he'd cast aside as stupid. Then the things Elodie had said to him. He clenched his eyes tight shut. She'd known, but just like Gaunt had done with Kolia, Baskerville had allayed her fears, because it just couldn't have been true. Now she was dead. Now so many were dead. Nobody had listened. Dower's wife was dead because Baskerville hadn't taken her seriously. Kolia got up suddenly. "Gol?" Baskerville rose and put his hand on Kolia's arm.
"I've still got a son,"
Kolia said, and pulled his arm away. He walked over to Dallin, who was hunched against the wall. Baskerville joined Blenner and Gaunt. They watched Kolia approach the boy.
"He just needs time,"
Baskerville said quietly. Gaunt nodded.
"What did he say?" asked Blenner.
"What do you think?"
Baskerville replied.
"I don't know. I was just wondering."
"He can't believe it. Even now it's happened," said Baskerville. "He blames himself. He blames everybody. That part'll go. But he'll never stop blaming himself. He's not making much sense at all, to be honest."
"Well, he wouldn't," Blenner nodded. "I mean, a shock like that. A tragedy. It had shaken a man to his core. It's shaken all of us. I doubt an ounce of sense would come out of him. Just a load of old nonsense."
"What?"
asked Baskerville.
"I just meant," said Blenner, awkwardly, "we can't expect him to make any sense. Not at a time like this. He'll probably say all sorts of things. Rant and rave, you know, until the pain eases. A trauma like this, that could take years."
Baskerville stared at him.
"Are you trying to make some kind of point?" he asked.
No, said Blenner.
As they watched, Kolia knelt down, facing Dallin. He reached out and put his trembling hands on the young man's shoulders.
"Dal,
leave me alone," said Dallin.
"I don't know what to say, Dal," Kolia said. "I don't think there's anything anyone can say."
"She said plenty," said Dallin quietly. all those weird things. She was always so strange. But she was my sister.
He paused.
I thought she was, he added.
Darling, let's go up. Get out of here, eh? Kolia said.
She was always so strange,
Dallin said, staring at Gull.
Growing up, all her games, all her stories, I used to love them. Now I remember every one of them, and I see how creepy they were.
Come on, now.
Then the things she said tonight, when I found her, the things she said, they didn't make any sense. But then her stories about bad shadows didn't make any sense either, and they were true. She told me there was a war machine. That was true. What if all the things she said were true?
Like what? Kolia asked. Dallin shook his head. Look, son, none of us could have known, said Kolia.
I'm not your son.
Now, listen. None of us could have known. Not me, not you, not...
He stopped.
There was still a burning anger inside him. He hated himself for it, but the anger was directed at Ibram Gaunt. Kolia had laid it all out, exposed everything that had plagued him, and Gaunt had just talked him out of it. He'd brushed all the fears away, found ways to account for every strange detail, and swept it all out of sight. If he'd listened. But no, he'd have an answer for everything. Your mind's confused, Gull. The ruinous powers play games. Even the arch-enemy wouldn't lay a plan that elaborate. They couldn't see the future and be that many steps ahead. A brother would know his sister. Kolia looked at Dallin. That had been the clincher, the one that had really changed Gull's mind. A brother would know his sister.
What did she say to you, Dallin?
He asked. Dallin shook his head again, lips pursed, fighting back tears, and not daring to speak. Dallin, what did she say to you?
It was all true, wasn't it? Dallin sobbed. It was all true, and I didn't know.
Kolia pulled him close and wrapped his arms around him. Dallin wept against his chest.
Easy, Dal, easy, he murmured. What was it she said to you?
Dallin whimpered a response that Kolia couldn't hear with the boy's face buried in his chest. He eased Dallin back, wiped the tears from his cheeks, and looked him in the eyes.
I'm here, he said. You can tell me. I'll protect you.
You can't, whispered Dallin.
Of course I can. I made that oath, remember? The Kolia oath. Walk into hell to protect you.
You couldn't protect Jons?
Well, I couldn't. Because she wasn't mine, was she? But you. You are. You're my son.
Not really. I'm not really.
Ah. So our road through life's been an odd one. So what? That's all right. Blood is blood. So come on. What did she say that upset you so much?
Dallin stared at him.
She said...
There were two of them, Papa, said Dallin.